again, everyone. It's Kaz Beal, and this is Casual Conversations, where we talk to people who are very important to our world. And you can listen to this now on the audio podcast. And if you listen on audio, check out the video because it's really cool. You get to see our special guest. Our guest today is a very accomplished cinematographer. She's a director. She's also a, editor. And very nice to have Melissa Whiteley. How are you, Melissa? How you doing?
Very good. Thank you, Kaz. Nice to see you.
Yeah, nice to see you too, even though it's not in person, but it looks like we're in the same place. You know, you got the musical notes behind you and all that. Really cool.
So you gave away our trade secret. No, we're right in the same place. Don't break the illusion.
Yeah, you're over there, right? You're going in the right direction. I know where you are. So tell me, how did you get started? Like, are you interested in film, video in the beginning of your life cycle there or later on? How did that come about? Tell me a little bit.
It's an interesting journey. It all starts with E.T. My parents took me to see E.T. theatrically, and I was just entranced by everything that was going on the screen. So much so, I believe I was 5 at the time, that in the beginning of the film, if you're familiar with it, when they are about to leave E.T. behind, I got so excited that I stood up and started screaming, "Run, E.T., run!" And I tried to crawl over my parents' lap to get to the screen, somehow in my 5-year-old brain thinking the closer I got, they'd hear me and they'd bring the spaceship back and rescue E.T. I think that was the moment that my parents understood, uh-oh, we have a creative little artist on our hands to deal with. And at first, I wanted to act. And it wasn't until I hit high school that I started becoming more interested in the behind the scenes aspect of it. I like the fact that I didn't necessarily have to worry about looking good on set. I could just sort of show up in jeans and a flannel and climb around behind stage, build sets, things like that. So then I started really exploring what it would be like to be a director and a writer. And
well, Melissa, look what's right over there. Look what's there.
Ah, beautiful. See? Wonderful.
I let you know, my nephew, who was, when I went to see him very young, cried. We know when E.T. died, well, people thought he died. I don't want to give anything away, but he does. but it is, you know, fun ending in the end. So, and then I went on the E.T. ride, of course, at Universal Studios, the bike. Everybody had to do that.
Yes.
And so after that, when you grew up a little bit, tell me more about what happened and how you got to actually have White Light Productions. I love the title. It's sort of like Casual Conversations. Use that last name with a different letter code in there to make it work. That's awesome. So tell me your progression there. What happened after that?
Well, out of high school, I started working for a local cable company. So again, learning a lot of behind the scenes aspects of television and film production. And I guess maybe 3 or 4 years after working semi-full time, I was a professional freelancer. I was able to save up enough money to go to film school. And I went to the New York Film Academy. And that's where I really had the opportunity to network with other filmmakers and hone my craft and discover the aspects of film that I'm very good at and the others that I need support in. One thing I tell people all the time is, please don't ever ask me to light your film for you. We'll be here for months until I get the lighting right. That's not one of my strengths. Same with audio, just not my strength. But it was nice to be able to network with other people that they were good at that. So we figured out how to build a team and a true production crew and highlight everybody's strengths.
Well, and you have to understand all the other aspects. You just come in and say, I'm the director, and you know, like things happen. You have to understand and appreciate the other talent in a business. And it helps, I think, in the process. Because if you don't, then you know, negativity sleeps in. Who the heck are they? They didn't never you know, actually picked up a light, and how do they know how to, you know, the dark side, you know, is here, like, you know, there's a little darkness on this side of me, or whatever, you know, it's. But, you know, it's, you have to appreciate that. When I went to Rutgers, I remember them saying they had a color control room and everything, had the old black and white set up for the students at the time. And they said, see that over there? That's great. That's like the icing on the cake. But if you don't know, like if you're doing a talk show and you don't know there's a guest coming on, that third camera should move over there, be on that shot before they come on. You're going to miss that. Probably the most important moment, they might trip or whatever, and you're going to miss that. So you have to understand how it all works, from writing to, you know, to a concept to that you can actually pull it off in budget. You know, you can have this great idea, blow up a block, but, you know, use a little tiny pieces instead of a real block.
Thank you. No, I'm so glad that you brought that up, because that is one of the challenging things too, is some people, when I talk to them about, you really should explore going to a film school. Well, I don't need film school. I have this great script. They show me the script. It's like 120 pages. They want to recreate a beach scene in somebody's backyard. And my question for them is, it's a great idea. What's your budget? Oh, well, I don't know. I'm just going to get a couple of friends to donate. It's like, okay, I don't want to step on your dream, but you also have to be somewhat realistic. If you're an independent filmmaker coming up, it's your first film, maybe scale it back to something that you can afford to do. Right. So you don't get frustrated and give up on the dream.
You know, or the positive and negative technology is everybody thinks they have the whole studio in their pocket right here. Three cameras, I can zoom, I can do everything, I edit on it, I can do it. So what do I need all this other people's support for? Like, I can do it all. Like, what's the deal? I can somewhat edit it, you know?
And that is frustrating, because like you said, it's amazing now that we have this technology. So it's not like you have to go out to LA, you can only shoot on film, you have to have a crew of 500 people. No, you could make a film with maybe 50 people supporting you.
Right.
But you have to understand the craft. And like I said, sometimes when I say that to people, they roll their eyes. I don't like to follow rules. I'm not saying you have to follow the rules. You have to understand what the rules are. So when you break them, if someone calls you on it, you can say, yes, the reason that we have most of the shots of this one particular character wider, not close, is because she is disconnected from herself. And when she reconnects with herself and realizes who she is, you'll notice the shots are a little tighter. So yeah, it might feel weird because it's like, oh, it's not true format proper. Intentionally not format
proper. No, the other thing, my world is a lot of 30-second commercials, you know, which is movies in 30 seconds. If you go, oh, that's a simple thing. Go out there and just do some things and have people talk. But I tell them everything has a story. It could be now 15 seconds, 10 seconds, but it's a story. Like, I don't know if you remember Betty White, who just turned 100, but that football commercial, you know, just her standing there and boom, she gets smashed on the ground, you know, and you see the product, like, okay, you know the story. It's like the football, it's kind of fun. It gives you energy, makes you feel good. I mean, that's what I got out of it. And like, you don't know, there's all psychology behind all these things too. And sound is another issue, because I tell people that, you know, the picture could be, you know, bad if it's live or whatever, but the you'd not get forgiven if they can't hear what the heck you say. Like what? You know what I mean? I'm faking up. No power. Nothing went out, folks. I just fake it up. But that's the impact you have. It's like, you know, you can forgive that picture, but if they can't hear what you're trying to say and your message, you're done. You're toast.
Right.
You know, so in movies, you have to have sound. You have to hide the microphones, you know, overhead mics, everything. People go, how did they get that sound so clear? Then you hear the water and you hear everything perfectly. How did that happen? You know, and you see some behind the scenes stuff, and it's all those details making, you know, a fine movie and also a documentary as well, because that's a whole different form of story building. So I'm going to make a transition to your great documentary that you did, which is kind of a bizarre documentary from White Light Productions. So tell me, why is it bizarre?
Oh, it's very bizarre. The producers who came to me originally, they had this great idea. And I joke, because I say this in every single interview I'm in. The producers came to me and said, yeah, we want to do a documentary about a mall that we loved when we were kids. And once again,
that's bizarre.
I'm willing to listen to people and see what they're thinking and where they're coming from with it. Because I'm thinking, yeah, you know what? I have great stories from hanging out at malls in like the early 90s. I don't think anyone's going to want to pay to see those stories, as sentimental as they are to me. But when the producer started to explain to me that really what this was one of the first prototypes of an indoor mall that opened in the 1960s.
Yeah.
Then it became kind of interesting to explore the history and just how many people came there celebrities. So it's like, all right, this was more than just, you know, your standard mall, if you will. And it really was like Main Street indoors. So it was a community place. Once again, I keep saying when we're thinking about modern malls, you're thinking there's a Gap, there is a Macy's. It wasn't like that at all. It was just the local townsfolk who were opening their shops. So it was much easier to shop. The kids could be playing at the arcade while mom is getting a million and one things done all in one safe space.
Well, it's a different type of bazaar. The bazaar meaning small little shops, as if to bazaar like this is bizarre, dude, like that craze. Well, it kind of was bizarre in some spots, but double meaning, which I love this double meaning play with, you know, casual conversations, the light. It's kind of the theme I see going here. So let's show them a nice little, I guess, mini version of that documentary, what it was all about. And again, storytelling is the key here, because what I like to see again is, you know, people documentaries. I've done some short ones. And what I like is when the people tell the story, one person leads to another. I don't like the documentaries where you go, and now we're going to see how the thing went to this, there. It's like, let one person lead to the next person, next to the person. And if it's done correctly, it's a great way of storytelling. So anything else you want to say before we roll this clip?
Nope. Let the clip speak for itself.
Okay.
Bazaar was very busy from the first day it opened.
The bazaar was every small business's dream, to start a business, not be killed by the amount of the mall's prices. It was a dream that a shoemaker had. He could open a store, a wallpaper guy, paint store, a small arcade.
I mean, there was no better customer service that you could get if you walked into one of those stores, because most likely, the first person that was going to ask you if they could help you was the owner.
It was a real sense of camaraderie, a real sense of family there.
The bazaar was a time of innocence where people actually liked everyone. They respected people. If someone who was older than you asked you to do something, you did it. You didn't talk back. You didn't give them an attitude. You just did it. And those people always looked out for you. If you had a problem, they were there for you.
The fact that you would know people, you felt comfortable there. It was like a second home in a way.
The bazaar, it was just anything. You know, it was a group of vendors that came together, and they just were all competing against each other, so to speak, but they were all partners in the same thing, and they were side by side.
I was 6 years old. We had just moved to Clifton Heights. The first thing my father taught me was how to get home from the bazaar, and I'm not kidding, because he knew we would be there all the time.
For every stage of life, there's something interesting for you. When you were a kid, you know, there was this cool model shop, and there was one or two really cool toy stores. And of course, you know, like a water ice place and a pretzel place. When you're a teenager, the record shop is more interesting.
Christmas wasn't Christmas till you went to the bazaar.
When there was an event, everybody came out.
And they set up, you know, this bomb shelter, and the family lived in there.
The police, Upper Ivy Police and the Springfield Police, used to call it the Twilight Zone. It was down in the valley, and they said when they came down there, man, anything goes.
It just wasn't a place to go shopping for me. It wasn't just a place to go get a pretzel or go get a piece of pizza or hang out on Friday night. It was basically my life. My mother was there, my brother was there. It was a daily stop in to like see the family.
You know, the bazaar felt like yours, and it is yours.
And once that bazaar was gone, we knew there was nothing else out there like it.
Oh, that was not bizarre. that was pretty cool what we saw there. And it's nothing like live stories, listen to people's lives. And if you were there, I think in Central Jersey, where I kind of grew up and live, is Route 18 Marketplace was very similar to that, which no longer exists. The Walmart took it over, I believe. They knocked it down, but it was so cool, you know, to go in there and just see so many different merchants and, you know, shop back and forth and everything. So So how did that turn out? Did the response you got from people?
Oh, it was wonderful. We opened on Thanksgiving weekend 2010 because the goal was we wanted to have it available for the 50th anniversary of the bazaar opening. So we just like busted our butts. Unfortunately, we didn't have that plan in place when the whole project began. But when I started looking at the timeline, it was like, let's really guys gun it. We want this ready to go. Cause I think just to celebrate it even more, people get a buzz out of that. So it opened theatrically. We sold out opening night, which was amazing. I think it ran theatrically. Gosh, like I said, I'm going back to 2010, trying to remember, but it probably ran for 2 months theatrically, which for an independent documentary, that's amazing. Then we started selling the DVDs, sold out our first batch, had to reorder, make more. We decided that we're kind of like falling off on sales. So we started to make it virtual. So you can purchase it online now. It just makes more sense.
Yeah, it does. Yeah, and we'll put all the links below so you can link up to that and download it and watch it, enjoy it and share it, whatever you want to do, because, you know, it's a casual way of doing these days. You know, you can just click and watch whatever you want, wherever you want, wherever you are.
And we still have people that are reaching out to us, like asking us questions about it. How did it come together? They want more information. Cool. Then a representative from WHYY reached out to us and they wanted to screen it on their channel. And we were just like, this is amazing. Coming back to editing, Kaz, the feature length of the documentary, I believe, was an hour and a half. Mm-hmm. And HYY said it needed to be 60 minutes, an hour. Mm-hmm. Oh, so that was really fun trying to figure out what to cut. Because, like I said, everybody we spoke to, people that we interviewed, but also the fans of the film, connected in different spots. So it's almost like, well, what can we cut that we're not going to offend somebody by making that cut? Yeah. And we talk, the producers and I, and it's like, we can't please all the people. Somebody's going to get mad at us. We have to be the grown-ups in the room, make the executive decision. Yeah. And when they push back, just say, we had to make it a 60-minute film for HYY, and we wanted to share it with more people. So hopefully the
they always had the original version they can look back and you know.
Oh, of course.
So what's the, you know, it's the big deal. So let's move on to the full-length feature now that you want to talk about. So tell me a little bit about that. This is full-length. This is not a short documentary, mini, anything. It's full length. So what does that mean, full length?
Full length is anything, they've kind of changed the rules now. Anything over 74 minutes, I believe, is what they consider to be a full length now. And we're discussing Leaving Virginville. Is that correct, Kaz?
Yes.
Okay. That's actually what I was writing and working on before the Bizarre documentary came about. And how I met the producer for the Bizarre documentary was he's a musician who had gone to Catholic school. I was writing the script myself and I did not go to Catholic school. So I just wanted to bounce some ideas off of somebody to make sure that I was portraying what it feels like to be in that environment accurately. And like I said, while I was working on that film,
In action, there you are.
Look at me, close to my actors all times. Always want to be there to support them. While I was working on that, like I said, the Bizarre documentary came up. And so I put my film on hold just until we could get the Bizarre done. So that was in the can. I was back on Leaving Virginville. What a wonderful experience. I have to say, I am really blessed every time I cast, whether it's a short or a feature film, just amazing actors. They are supportive. They are respectful of the work. They show up on time, which is a blessing in this industry.
Most important, show up on time.
Tell me about it.
You got to show up on time because, you know, when this happens, things got to roll. So I got that just for you, by the way. You know,
thank you.
You only get one take, though. You don't get a redo.
Put too much pressure on me.
You're a pro. You're a pro.
But the cast was great. So Casey Hayes Dietz, who you saw in that picture where I was holding the slate, she is in the majority of the film, almost every single scene. So she really carried it. Just an amazing person. Anthony Perowski is also in it, who went on to be part of Queer Eye, the latest reboot of that. He is credited as Anthony Porter because this was a passion project for him. So it was kind of one of those, we're just going to do this and not alert too many people about it. But so I got to work with him before he became part of the Queer Eye cast. Mm-hmm. Okay. Just an amazing, amazing guy. Really, okay, really dedicated.
Super. Let's roll a little clip of this great Leaving Virginville. And we can discuss more right afterwards. So get ready, folks. This is pretty interesting. Don't get too mellowed out because something exciting happens in the middle, okay?
I mean, if you view things from a scientific angle, you will rely on data to explain your existence. But the fact of the matter is, at some point, all logic requires belief and a leap of faith.
Really? Great story.
Well, I won't insult your apparently superior intelligence any further by claiming to know exactly how you feel. But I do know that when you lose an important relationship at a young age like you...
This has nothing to do with him! So my father is dead, so what? People die. It happens every day.
I was talking about your relationship with God.
Are you going to talk to Clymer for me or not?
I tried.
So I'm out.
You can come in and talk anytime you want to.
Not if I'm expelled.
You're expelled from school, not this office.
Well, you're not expelled from this show, Casual Conversations there, Melissa. So you can stay here for a little while longer as we discuss. So far, what is the plan with Leaving Virginville? Tell me.
We shopped it around a couple of film festivals. And we got accepted to a handful. We won one. And of course, I cannot think of the name of which one we won. But the laurels on the poster art. Just very, very exciting. Again, playing with words, because this is what I like to do. And talking about how amazing my cast is. Mm-hmm. There is a town in Pennsylvania called Virginville.
Wow.
And that's something that inspired the screenplay for me back in, gosh, I'm going to say the late 90s when I was going on a job driving past Virginville. I just started thinking to myself, what on earth must it be like to live in a town named Virginville, right? Mm-hmm. So you can really kind of have fun with that. And then my character Faith was just born of that idea. So what was interesting was when I handed the script to my cast, independently, I would say three of them came to me and said, do you know there's actually a town called Virginville? And I said, yes, I did. So thank you for doing your research. So I was able to explain to them that, yes, the title is a little bit of a pun because it means obviously two things. It's Faith becoming aware of what she really and truly believes in this world. And as we all grow up, sometimes we have to learn some hard lessons and the acceptance of that. And she's just one of my favorite characters that I ever wrote. I love her so much. And people have wanted me to do a sequel to the film. And I said, I kind of just want to leave her where she ends up because I love her and I don't want to lose that person that I created.
Well, it's nice. I went to Catholic school up to eighth grade. So, you know, I got to watch the movie to see how close it is to reality. All right, so let's move on to... 2018 and the Fishbowl. So tell me about that.
The Fishbowl is a variety show that I created that airs, as you can see, in the Comcast market. This came from the idea that a couple of friends and I, we've done a lot of short films and we've submitted them to film festivals, but I was looking for another place that we could share our art. So I was able to find time on Comcast and I just created this. I think the first three episodes are from people that I personally know. And we put this work together and submitted it. And it's a great place to kind of let us play. However, the pressure to produce the art that quickly to come up with another show, I do it monthly. I just want to have a new show released.
Yeah,
that's still a lot.
Well, so, I know what you're going through because during COVID, a friend of mine started a program called Studio at the Hill, which basically is for families who are stuck at home. And the person I work with is I guess, a stand-up comedian. He's a magician. He's does all kind of puppeteer with the puppets and all. And we brought some other people in to do that. And then we had actually the premiere in a real movie theater. So we invited guests, the people on the show, and we looked at ourselves on the big screen, which is so freaking awesome. We had to convert to the format, but it when it played and the walls shook with, you know, hearing your voice and seeing yourself up there. I play a character called Ricky Review, which is like a movie review guy. I used to do a movie review show. You probably might know that.
I do.
but this one's kind of does a little, well, you got to check it out. We'll put the link to that below too. It's called Studio at the Hill. And there's an episode on Amazon Prime you can watch right now. So if you type in Kaz Bielan, the episode will come right up. It's on Amazon Prime. So that's what I've been sort of doing, among other things that I do and talking to you, which is. So what do you find from people who see your product, your films, you know, students, let's say, what do they ask you? Like one of the few things they ask you, the most important that you can remember at the top of the list.
Gosh, that's a great question. I was invited back to speak to one of my community college classes, film classes. And I was pretty honest with them. I said to them, as hard as you think it is to make a film, short or feature, it's 10 times that hard. Yeah. But as rewarding as you imagine it is, it is 20 times that when it all works.
Right.
And one of my teachers who invited me back kind of pulled me aside and said, "Ooh, that was a little harsh."
No.
Well, thank you. And that was my point was, like I said, I don't want to burst anybody's bubble, but this is a lot of work. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I think we have these ideas, especially when we're younger, that the first thing we do, oh my gosh, it's going to be the greatest thing that was ever made and everyone's going to love us and we're going to be flying on jets to LA. And I think for every artist, they have to try and decide why they are, if they're filmmakers, why are you a filmmaker? What do you want to get out of it? Or same thing if you're a musician too, what are you doing this for? And if it's for me personally, I try and create art that I can connect with other people.
Right.
My art's not going to be for everybody. There are going to be some people that just don't get it at all. I'm sure there are a lot of people that won't like it.
Well, let me tell you, though, the thing you got to get used to is you do it and you love this thing, or you spend those so much time on those few seconds because there's some kind of sound effect or just the look or something, and you think they're going to all notice it and they go, "Oh, yeah, that was nice." You know, like, right. You don't realize if we spend all day just to get that, make sure that car comes in a scene there and do that, you know. But what's fun to me is like sometimes much later out of nowhere, they go, "Hey, by the way, I just noticed what you were trying to do there," you know, and that's the reward. So like we don't get the rewards instantly there all the time, because if we say it, they're going to say, "Oh, you're just trying to say you're Miss Hottie Toddy. Look at that. I can do right. All this. I'm a big shot director." Woo-hoo. Yeah. So you have to like sometimes hint them in on it, but the best is when they come up and they say, "Hey, that was like the best thing. I understand what you're trying to do." I remember hearing when I used to do the movie show from people at a local level that, because it was a pay-per-view, so I couldn't really say the movie sucks, you know, whatever. So I had to say, "Well, you know, the movie's kind of okay, but you got to see why it's kind of worth watching," and that kind of thing. And someone came up actually says, "You know, I know what you're trying to say there, because you know, you're being paid to promote it. You can't really say it sucks or it's bad, but I got you." You know, by using the clips or, you know, reacting to something like that, they kind of read between the lines or whatever you call it, and they got it. And a lot of that time is sort of psychology, because what I like to do is to create something and then see, okay, if I was watching this, what's the next thing I would be thinking of? And sometimes I just do that and go, "You know what, Melissa, I know you were thinking just that." And they go, "Wait a second, how did he know what I was about to think?" It's because the plot and everything led you to thinking that, you know, and that's why those were the fourth wall, whatever they call that, when the person actually breaks the character and goes, "Yes. Hey guys, I know you're still here watching this movie, all right? So let me continue, okay? I gotta go, bye." And the story continues. Just, I love stuff like that because it wakes people up and it kind of gives them like a connection. So like, "Oh, so I know something that those people in the movie don't know because they're talking to me, telling me some stuff I should, the path I should go up." But that's another way to approach this stuff. I'm sure you know about that, but, you know.
I'm just laughing because I'm the worst person to watch a movie with, because I've, again, what I tell people too is please study, please study, please study.
Yeah.
Watch movies that were made before you were born, especially to younger people. Yeah. I suggest that because you're going to find stuff and you're going to find your voice. Something that people tease me about, and I totally own this. When I was 17, Pulp Fiction was like the greatest thing that ever happened. And I walked around saying, I'm going to be the female Quentin Tarantino. And I thought that was amazing.
Yeah.
And as I got older, it was like, yes, you know what? I love Tarantino's work, but that's Tarantino's voice.
Right.
Now I can learn things from him. I can be influenced from him, but I want to find Melissa Whiteley's voice and tell Melissa Whiteley's tales. So I think if people study, they can find what they like and what they don't like. And it's okay to not like everything. So kind of coming back to what you were saying about the pay-per-view things, art's subjective.
Right.
So I'm not offended if you don't like my work. I would like you to tell me what you didn't like and
right.
in a respectful fashion.
Yeah.
Don't just say, well, it sucked. Okay.
Well, I think the thing you were, the thing you were thinking, talking about, the thing is the official name is the auteur theory. I wonder in film it said that because each director has like, that's their author. That's their thing. If you watch enough of their films, you go, that's that. Capra was, you know, famous, if you know, film director, Capricorn, but it was all a style that, you know, is now Quentin's another one. You're going to see violence. You're going to see that, you know, there's certain things that they connected with. Spielberg had a certain way, whatever he does, you know, there's a certain musical level and quality and, you know, beauty to it, even though it's a whole different genre and everything, but like, you never think you'd do a musical. He just did a musical because he always wanted to do a musical, but he went and, but that's a, that was a risk he took to go in there. You know, even though he can do whatever he wants now, but he chose that because for some reason it, you know, it had a memory for him or whatever and inspired. So you have to, and you also, you can't, I think the point you try to say is you can't be afraid of taking that risk. And if people say it sucks, it bombs, whatever, okay, but learn from it and move on. It could be 10 years later, someone's going to say, I know I thought it was horrible, but I just saw it a different way. And it's like one of the best things you've ever done. And you see that throughout history, early films that were done, you know, famous directors, people, that was horrible. And they look back and they go, oh my God, that was like when they were young, they're already doing that, but no one realized that because they didn't see it. The timing was wrong. That era wasn't accepting, like, you know, the musicals having a trouble because certain audiences, an older audience for that. And, you know, Music Man, everybody loved, but this one for some reason so far is struggling, but you never know. After Oscars, it could suddenly rebound.
Yeah.
But that's the industry. You never know. Let's see. How about you also created something pretty cool, the festival, right?
Yes.
Light in the Dark Fest.
Yeah.
That sounds scary, but it's kind of cool.
Well, that's an interesting thing. That ties in with the fishbowl. Like I was saying, my friends and I, we kind of shared all of our art. And then it's like, oh my gosh, we have to, well, I shouldn't say we. I choose to keep producing this variety show. So now I needed to find more artists. And all of a sudden it was like, how selfish of me to just reach out to the people I know and give us this opportunity. Why don't I expand that? So then the question is, well, how do I meet new artists that I'm not familiar with? So a film festival seemed the natural way to do that. And it's very, very odd. The title came to me in a dream. One night, no, this is very strange. One night I was just having a nightmare that I was in a dark space somewhere.
Did you see a light? Did you see a light?
Well, wait for it, Kaz. Wait for it. You're predicting it. You don't know what direction the story is going.
Okay.
So I'm in a dark space and I'm feeling around and I realize that I'm in a wood because I'm feeling branches and stuff and I'm just terrified. And I'm crawling on the ground, reaching down, and my hand finds a flashlight. And I turn the flashlight on. And as soon as I started shining the beam around, I realized that I wasn't the only one in the forest alone and frightened. And I saw a whole bunch of other people there. And I was like, look, I've got a light. Follow me. I think we can get out of here. And that was like 4 years before I created a Light in the Dark Film Festival. So when it came time to try and find a name for it, that dream just kept haunting me. And I'm like, isn't that exactly what that dream was all about? Was finding other people and collectively working together and sharing the struggle and moving as a group and just supporting each other. So hence A Light in the Dark was born.
Yeah, very cool. There's always these inspirations, things that happen to you, and later you reflect back on your childhood or whatever, and these things magically or whatever, some way in the world, something makes you bring all that together and create wonderful things like you've been doing so far. Let's see, what else? I know one of the things I miss talk about is Scenes Missing. Go back, time machine to 2008. just tell me quickly about that, because I did forget that. I'm trying to figure out whether I should cut that. Cut, get it, take three. Okay, and what you explain what this is meant for, because some people might see that just like a little stupid toy in movies, but tell people what that's about. Let's do a little movie lesson 101. 30 seconds, go.
Well, that's a slate. You're supposed to put all the information on there appropriate for yourself and for your editor. So yeah, scene 21, it's take two of scene 21, the director's name, the cinematographer's name, and then that's easier for you in post to edit it. You should have somebody on the set, if you're lucky enough, to be keeping a log of what takes are good takes, what takes are not good takes, for either a performance reason or a technical reason. So when you get down to editing, you can say, all right, scene 21, take 15 is designated as the best, and God help me if I ever have to do 15 takes in one scene. But I love Stanley Kubrick, so you know he's influenced. Maybe
you know what I think. You know what I think about that explanation. You want to know? Wow, that was that looks like you. That was a great explanation. I give you 100% and A+ on that one.
Thank
Very
you.
Good. You passed the test on the movie. Let's see, movie theory and movie elements and parts and creative things like that. So, what is your favorite thing to do? Editing, writing, directing. Out of all those, don't say all of them because you can't pick all of them. Or put an order: 1, 2, 3, or pick one and go. Jeopardy music.
It's tough. No, it's tough. In the past, I would have said directing. I was never extremely confident of myself as a writer until leaving Virginville. And then I started getting so much feedback from my cast, and I thought, I've got to cut myself some slack. So now I kind of like writing. But yeah, it's a tie. It depends upon what personality I'm in that day. If I just want to be alone in my own headspace, I think writing is my favorite thing. But then if I'm feeling a little more social, I think I'm a very, very good director. And I've gotten that feedback from people that I'm very supportive of my cast and my crew. And when we're working together, and that's something that I do try and impress upon younger people when they're coming up, treat everyone with respect. Mm-hmm. We're all working on the same project. Mm-hmm. I'm lucky enough as a director that, like I was saying at the beginning of this interview with you, Kaz, that I don't have to look picture perfect at 5 a.m., I can look sloppy. I can have bags under my eyes. My eyes are all bloodshot. My actors don't have that. So I want to be as supportive as I can for them. Be that safety net. If they have to do something very emotional, mm-hmm. I want them to know as a director, I'm here with you. We're going to go to dark places. It might be painful, but I am your safety net. If anything feels wrong, talk to me and we'll workshop it. Again, same with my crew too. Hey, if I'm asking you to do something and you're like, Melissa, I can't run that fast with this camera on my shoulder and get you a steady shot, please communicate that to me. I don't want you to be so frightened that, ooh, she's the director. Yeah. She's not going to understand. We'll figure out another plan and we'll workshop it together. And that's where I think the strength as a director comes across. So like I said, flip of a coin. If I'm antisocial that day, writer. If I'm social, director.
Hey, Melissa. Melissa, yes. Thank you for being a great guest on Casual Conversations. White Light Productions is where you can go to get all the information. Plus, we'll put additional links to wherever else Melissa will provide us for the movie clips where you can watch and order the movies and other documentaries and whatever projects has created and ongoing. I'm sure everything will be on whitelightproductions.com. Update constantly. Final big question, Melissa Whiteley, CEO of White Light Productions, is what do you think of this conversation that we've been having?
I think it's very informative, and I do hope if there are young artists out there, they seriously do listen, because everybody has the opportunity now. Like we were saying, the technology is available. It's cheap enough that we can do this, but make yourself stand out. Just study, 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 listen to other people, yeah. Take in other influences and craft your own voice.
Well, thank you. You know, I interviewed a painter who does wonderful paintings, and he says, how'd you get into it? And he says, hey, just paint. You know, it's like, just go and you have the phone, whatever camera, do some scenes, record it, do some little edits. Don't be afraid to try it again. You might discover that special thing that you never knew your ability had in you, and to share your stories, share good things, bad things, whatever you want to do. And you can affect people's lives in yes. so many ways, not just at the moment you did it, but future.
Yep.
It's just ongoing. So thanks again. Melissa, any final words from you?
Everybody be safe, be well, and take care of each other.
Hey, and keep having those great casual conversations with anybody else you like, not just me. I'll give you full permission to go ahead and do that, and keep doing short films, feature films, documentaries, whatever else you do, TV shows. And hopefully we'll connect someday and do a project or something. That'd be really cool, you know, because
nice.
Why not?
Thank you very much, Kaz, for having me.
Okay, bye.